Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are here with
Claudia Myers,
who is not only, full disclosure, my former writing and directing and professor from American University when I was getting my master's, but she has gone on to become an awesome indie filmmaker and do it all out of D.C., so an inspirational figure for anyone around here that's making movies or wants to make movies. But we're here talking about your newest movie, Above the Shadow, so thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
All right, before we dive in, I've seen, I think, an early cut of it a couple months ago, but just remind them what the general premise is, because it's a cool gimmick here.
Thank you. So it's Above the Shadows is about a young girl who becomes invisible after her mother dies, and she has to find her way back into the world with the help of the one man who can see her, and he happens to be a disgraced MMA fighter.
I love that little twist. He just happens to be.
Yes.
I've seen it, and it's almost like, you know how people, when they pitch things, it's this meets this. It's like Ghost meets Rocky.
Yeah, I was going to say Rocky. I'm glad you did.
That's what I would say. But it's got that magical realist element. You know, when people say fantasy, they think, you know, Lord of the Rings or other planet, Game of Thronesy stuff. But my favorite fantasies have always been the magical realist, extraordinary things happening in the ordinary world, like your Fields of Dreams and Wonderful Lives and Groundhog Days and stuff like that. And so this speaks to that a lot. And is this your first time dabbling in that territory? Because I know you did Kettle of Fish, which was like a rom-com, and then Fort Bliss, military movie. Is this the first fantasy-ish?
Definitely first fantasy-ish. This is just the way the story came to me. You know, it was inspired by my childhood, and I guess at the time, invisibility didn't feel like a metaphor. It felt like a very tangible state of existence. So that was kind of the jumping off point for me writing a story about a girl who is literally invisible and yet completely functions normally in the world.
All right, so let's unpack that a little more. You just said about how it was based on your own childhood and feeling invisible. What do you mean by that?
Well,
like, what are you tapping into, right? What you know, kind of a thing.
I mean, I think the feeling of being, you know, misunderstood, unseen, feeling underappreciated, feeling overlooked. I think these are all feelings that a lot of us have when we're, you know, growing up, especially I think as you're transitioning to adulthood and you feel like nobody understands you. You know, and my particular family dynamic definitely elevated that. Mm. But I think the sort of the feeling at its core is if not universal, pretty widely experienced.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to write a story that kind of tapped into that. Like, you know, what does it mean to be seen? How do we, you know, derive our sense of identity? And ultimately what I was really exploring is, you know, how do we break out of the kind of prism of our own experience?
Awesome. So you take that own experience and you're like, I'm going to turn it into, it becomes the metaphor of the fantasy, if you will. So explain how this unfolds with the actual characters here. We have, who's the actress playing the main character?
So the main character, her name is Holly, and she's played by Olivia Thirlby.
Okay. And her dad's Jim Gaffigan?
Her dad is Jim Gaffigan. Her mother is played by Maria Dizia. And the disgraced MMA fighter, who is looking to resurrect his career, is played by Alan Ritchson. And Megan Fox and Tito Ortiz are also part of this really awesome cast.
Yeah. Well, everybody knows Megan from Transformers, and Tito is an actual UFC fighter, right?
Yes, he is.
Tell me about those. I want to get into the romance stuff in a second, but tell me about the fighting sequences. You've probably had to never film anything like that before, you know? Is Tito giving you pointers, or how do you actually set out to shoot that?
Actually, Tito was really, helpful on set because he was really great working with Alan. But Alan Ritchson trained for about 6 weeks, learning basic MMA skills. He's really athletic to begin with. But he trained every day for 6 weeks. And we had designed the fights well ahead of time, so he learned the choreography. And then, he was doing all of that in L.A. and then came to New York and then sort of got a chance to rehearse with the various scene partners, since there are three different fight scenes in the film. And it took a lot of preparation. I mean, it was definitely one of the biggest challenges of a small indie film was, you know, how do we pull off these larger fight sequences? And I have to say, it was also really fun.
I bet it would be. And in terms of pivoting to the romance, fantasy elements, forgive me for always just keep referencing Ghost, but it's the first thing I think of in terms of, you know, right when Swayze, you know, is killed, and then he's got to, there's that period where he's got to learn, I guess that's sort of the fun and games part of the script, right, where he's got to learn how to deal with this new reality. He got to learn that he is dead with a ghost, and he's how to move objects from the guy on the train and reach back out to his lover, all that stuff. So what would you say in terms of when you're working with the actress that's playing Holly? What are you, when you're saying, like, you know, wants and needs in that whole good character work, what would you say it's overcoming? I mean, I know it's her, that she's got to not become invisible anymore, but what do you, actor-wise, what do you tell her want and need is?
Well, I think the thing that was interesting working with Olivia and sort of my whole approach to the film was to ground it as much as possible. So when you were saying, you know, there's a supernatural premise, but it's really grounded. Like, I figured out, how does she pay rent being invisible? How does she make a living? How does she get her groceries? And all of that's kind of in the film, and I think that is part of the fun of it. And in terms of working with Olivia, it was really, you know, kind of identifying what the state of mind is. I mean, she has no one to talk to, and it's such a lonely existence, but there's a kind of a mundane quality to it. Like, she takes the bus. She takes public transportation because she has to. She can't hail a cab, and she can't drive a car. And so I think figuring out all that was part of what kind of oriented her and grounded her character in the film. And in terms of her want, it's absolutely to be seen. I mean, it's such a, it's a supernatural need in a way, but it's also a really primal need that we all have. We all want to be seen. We all want to be acknowledged. So in that sense, it made her, I think, very relatable and very human.
And then what do you, for the MMA fighter, what would you say what's his character journey? What is he missing at the beginning that he has at the end?
The same thing. I mean, they're really mirror characters in a way, because they're opposite in the sense that he was defined by his physicality and she's defined by her lack of anyone seeing her.
Right.
But, you know, he was a fighter. He was in the spotlight. That's exactly where he wants to be again. So
yeah.
they're kind of both yearning for their version of, you know, acceptance and validation.
To me, the best movies when I'm watching them or when I'm, you know, teaching a class are the ones where, you know, you sit down and you look at your students and you say, all right, on the surface, What is this about? And they give you the plot summary and say, all right, but now what is it really about? What's the subtext? That's how I open every one of my classes. And the students are like, whoa, a movie works on multiple levels? So in your mind, what, you know, on the surface, it's about this girl disappearing, but what would you say it's actually about?
So it's constructed as a fairy tale, and it's about a young woman who's invisible who wants to be seen. But in reality, it's about sort of taking the focus away from wanting to be seen and actually seeing others. And that's really what the movie's about.
Gotcha. Love it. Let's talk more aesthetically. We talked a lot of story and character work.
Yep.
Maybe almost too much. I need to trim some of that down.
We sure
but,
can.
But I don't know. I love that stuff. All right. So let's talk aesthetically. We talk a lot about character stuff. What sort of look or visual language did you, you know, want to have here in terms of lighting? Or did you have certain, you know, you do a long take for this character, or, you know, this character's always in wearing certain colors. I don't know. Stuff from a visual standpoint, what did you assign to each character, or just the overall style of how you wanted to shoot it?
Actually, the visual design for this film was so different than anything I've done. I have to say it was really fun and really unique to this particular film and this particular premise. So one of the big challenges was, how do I sell this premise of a girl who's invisible when we're seeing her on screen all the time? With a few exceptions, occasionally we'll jump into someone else's perspective and see her absence from the scene. So one thing is creating a world that doesn't feel like the ordinary world. So it's definitely a stylized world. Some of my references were images from graphic novels, from superhero movies, that there's this idea that she's kind of a reluctant superhero with this power that she doesn't want. But
right.
Nevertheless, once she develops an agenda through this character Shane, she's gonna wield her power in a way that serves her, and so part of it was kind of creating a world that felt out of time and that felt a little bit iconic, you know, kind of an iconic version of Manhattan, the dark alleys and the you know, the jewel colored nightclubs, and a lot of the movie is shot at night, And so the color palette was really important. Like I said, kind of sticking with these jewel tones. There's a contrast between the scenes that are set in the past that are flashbacks to when she was young and her mother was alive. And, of course, the world as she knows it, which is, you know, cold and dark and, you know, full of shadows. You know, a lot of the visual design was really based on mm-hmm. trying to make it seem like a page from a graphic novel.
I love it. Weren't there some, remind me, were there some crane shots or drone shots of in the alley looking down on the street? How did you achieve those?
Yeah, we did have a couple of drone shots in the movie, which kind of gives us some some space and some sense of scope. And also kind of puts her in the context of, you know, this lone figure in this big city.
And where in Manhattan? What part of the town? Because you're familiar with the city. You used to go to school up there and everything, so.
Yeah, we shot everywhere. We shot in almost all of the boroughs. So we shot a lot in Manhattan, Queens, and Brooklyn, primarily.
Gotcha. Where's her apartment?
Her apartment was in Manhattan.
Okay.
The fight scenes we shot in Queens and also at the Borgata in Atlantic City. We actually shot one of the fight scenes during a live event, which was a pretty wild experience because we got to, you know, work with a real crowd that was there to see an actual fight, and then we put our actors in the cage during the commercial break. So that was pretty...
Probably got rowdy.
It was just such a great experience, and the actors fed off of that energy, and I think you can really tell in the scene.
Remind me also, listeners, I watched this early cut of this about a year ago, so it's all coming back to me as we're talking. You mentioned the flashbacks with her and her mother. Isn't there like a little, is there an object or a familiar image? What was it, a photo?
Kaleidoscope.
Tell our listeners how the kaleidoscope is used here as sort of a familiar image and symbolic image, because in your previous movie, Fort Bliss, I remember there was a watch that they keep. Why do you think that kind of thing is important?
Well, the kaleidoscope is a central image in the film. It has a function in the plot, but it also is sort of a symbol of an object where you take the same shapes and you rearrange them and you get a whole new pattern. And if you watch the movie, you'll understand the importance of that.
I like it.
Concept.
It is it's an object that we all know, and we know the idea of a concept of a kaleidoscope, but I love when you take that and then it becomes a symbolic thing of the story we're watching itself. Cool. So tell me more about how it came together then. You know, just more logistics, like, you know, you said the boroughs you shot in, but how long of a shoot was it? That kind of thing.
So the shoot was 21 days, which was very challenging considering we had 26 locations. So if you do the math, you can see that it was difficult. The cast was phenomenal. I mean, it was just a lot of fun working with them. They worked really hard. Like I mentioned, Alan, you know, trained for 6 weeks before even coming to set. Yeah.
And how about any good, like, how's our listeners, you know, how does Jim Gaffigan behind the scenes, how's Megan Fox, like, how are they just on set as opposed to what we always see on the big screen?
I mean, they're consummate professionals, really. The working experience was obviously different with each actor, which is part of the fun of directing, is you adapt to the kind of the needs and the personalities of everyone you work with. But they were great. I mean, Jim Gaffigan is just also really funny in person and a joy to have around. So it was, you know, he's making everybody laugh between takes. But he was also, you know, his role is has some comedic aspects, but it's also dramatic in other ways. And so I think that was fun for him. And I think he connected to the material in a way that was profound. So
I love it. And just to put I want to go more into, you know, your briefly into like your life's journey and AU and making it all work as I look all that in a minute. But just before we wrap up on Above the Shadows, tell our listeners when they might be able to see it. I know it's playing at a festival here coming up soon and more to come.
Yeah, so it's going to be the opening night film of the Brooklyn Film Festival on May 31st, and there'll be a second screening on June 2nd. And we will be there doing Q&As with the cast. And then we will have, the film will open on July 19th in limited theaters and on SVOD. So
awesome. So do we know what, are there, is that the limited release, is that going to include anywhere in DC? Do we not know?
I hope so. Okay. I don't know. Maybe you can update that when we know.
Sure. Yeah. this isn't going to air for a while, so right. We can update that. Yeah. And then when you say it's, you know, going to be streaming, do we know what platforms yet or all
I'll
that?
Have that.
We'll figure that. We'll know that closer to the day.
Yeah.
I'll list that. Okay. I'm taking for granted that everyone knows who you are because I've known you for a while, but just briefly, just give us a little, just a chronological run through of your journey, you know, where you grew up, film school, and how you got to AU. I know that's a lot, but just the Cliff Notes version.
The Cliff Notes. Okay.
Film-wise.
So I grew up overseas in France. I came to the States for college. I worked in development for 4 years. I went to film school. I went to Columbia University. I made my first feature, which was called Kettle of Fish with Matthew Modine and Gina Gershon.
And before that, you had your thesis short, right, at Columbia? Did it play at Sundance?
I had a short film at Sundance, yeah, before that. And in some ways, I credit that with getting my first feature off the ground. I moved to D.C. I started doing work with the U.S. Army, which was definitely a departure for me and a completely eye-opening experience, and worked on several nonfiction films. I did 3 documentaries, television documentaries for the Pentagon Channel.
And some stuff for, like, Will Interactive, too.
And
like,
some stuff for Will Interactive.
Was it, like, training videos, kind
they
of?
They're called Virtual Experience Immersion Learning Simulations.
Right.
And they're interactive films that you watch like a movie and play like a video game, and they have a sort of a training purpose. And I did 2 of those with a company here called Will Interactive, and that was really the genesis of what became my feature film, which is fiction, called Fort Bliss with Michelle Monaghan and Ron Livingston. So that was a film that, you know, grew out of years of research and work with and for the military community. And that was a gritty drama.
Yeah.
I had written actually a very early draft of Shadow Girl even before Fort Bliss.
Yeah.
And then returned to it afterwards. And in between and throughout the time that I've been in Washington for at least the last 10 years, I've been a faculty member at American University School of Communication.
And didn't you have a script before we get to that? Didn't you have Wild Oats also was produced.
Yeah.
A script you wrote.
A script I wrote called Wild Oats was directed by Andy Tennant with Shirley MacLaine and Demi Moore and Jessica Lange.
I saw, it was wild. I remember going, I guess it was Target or Walmart, and seeing the DVD. I said, hey, I know her. Cool.
That's
all
right.
So then back to what you were saying at AU. How long have you been there now?
So I've been there for 10 going on 11 years.
I think my year was your first year. I think it was.
Was it really?
I think so. I think we were your freshman class, or
whatever.
Your first year was ours, yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, I teach screenwriting and directing there. I'm the co-head of the Art and Entertainment Concentration, which is essentially the fiction side of our program.
Because there's a lot of documentary filmmakers, being that it's in D.C., right?
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, and so what are you currently teaching now? Still writing and directing?
Writing and directing Yeah, I mean, I teach writing the short film. I teach a feature writing class. We're developing a sort of a new revision class that will include television. We have a directing actors class, which is very popular, and we're developing new directing classes as well. So I think the program is growing, and there seems to be an increasing interest in fiction, which I'm thrilled about.
Mm-hmm. So how do you balance just work-life balance then in terms of, or not even really work-life balance, but teaching filmmaking balance? Did you have to take a sabbatical to shoot Above the Shadows?
I did. I took a sabbatical to shoot Above the Shadows, and I was also on sabbatical when I did Fort Bliss.
Okay. So that for you then, the model now sort of, well, Kettle of Fish was before all this, but now you seem to like you're starting to get into a groove of how you do it then. It's you teach, you take a sabbatical, make your movie, teach a little more, take a sabbatical. Is that how you see it working for the foreseeable future, or would you ever think of ever going full-time into filmmaking, depending what happens?
I see myself remaining on the faculty at American University. That's my academic home. And I love making movies, but I couldn't imagine making a movie a year or,
right.
You know, being, you know, on set all the time. That doesn't suit my lifestyle, doesn't work for my family. And I really enjoy the balance of making a film and then teaching is a way to just kind of recenter myself, to challenge myself in a different way. And it also allows me to be kind of choosy about what I do because I have this other job. So I can really develop projects that are really meaningful to me and that I have a real passion for. Because filmmaking is always hard, and it's not always predictable. And you make it sound like there's just sort of nice linear schedule, but I feel every film is its own battle, especially in the independent space, and there's a lot of uncertainty. And so having the luxury of, you know, a stable position in a community of, you know, other filmmakers, other creators is, I think I'm really lucky.
Yeah, absolutely. So you do think it is possible then to do it from the East Coast, from DC, and you know, you think it like, you know, for you, you have that AU job, but for someone else it might be something else. But you think it is possible for other, if anyone's listening to this that wants to try to make a go of it, that they can do it here, as opposed to decades ago you had to go to the studio system in LA. But
I not only think it's possible, I think there's an argument that, you know, everyone in LA wants to make films. Right. And for certain types of jobs, you do need to be there. If you want to be a staff writer on a show, you need to be in LA. You know, for people who want to be writer directors, for people who want to just be screenwriters, for people who want to direct DC-based stories, not only do I not see a reason to like run out to LA, I think there's an argument that you stand out more. Not being from there. Mm-hmm. You know, when I go to LA.
So it makes you different.
It makes you different. It makes you stand out. There's also a real appetite for stories that come from outside of Los Angeles. You know, they're looking for different things. The films that I've made and the stories that I've encountered and some of the projects I'm developing, I would never have come across if I didn't live here.
Right.
And so I think it does make you stand out, and I think it's completely doable. I think.
Fly out there for your pitches, for your meetings, maybe even to shoot something every now and then, but. Have your life and your inspiration, the things that will fuel your next original idea, be here,
be anywhere. I mean, yeah. The world is definitely shrinking. And in fact, what I'm hearing now is, you know, for a first round, you don't even need to go out there and pitch. You can pitch on, you know, Skype or whatever. Right. And I've done some of those meetings too. And, you know, with very similar results. So, I mean, it's obviously nice to be in the room with people in it, and sure. It creates a different feeling. But, you know, you can do that by going out there once or twice a year. And I honestly have no intention of moving out there.
Yeah. Well, it's awesome. That's the dream. And that's what any, you know, aspiring filmmaker here would want to hear. That's the dream model right there. But it's one thing talking about it and then actually doing it. What's the key, you know, what do you think was the key that allowed you to do it, you know, post Kettle of Fish, you know, that got you, was it a connection with a producer that allowed you to make Fort Bliss, or, you know, what's the tangible thing that allowed you to start directing features here?
I think honestly, it's the strength of the idea. Okay. I think there will always be room for great ideas, great scripts, things that, you know, are unique. And I felt like when I was, you know, working with the military and I had come upon some of these stories and some of these circumstances that made me want to write the script about this single mother who's trying to balance her life as a soldier and her responsibilities as a mother.
Check that out if you haven't seen it, guys. Michelle Monaghan, yeah. You know her from True Detective and all kinds of stuff. But
when I was working on that film, I just had such a conviction that this was a story that needed to be told. And I think it made people pay attention. And it was, again, it was a story I wouldn't have come across if I hadn't moved here from New York. And I think people responded to that. They just felt like, you know, when people say, I haven't seen that before, that's a very good thing. And you can find that story that no one else has seen anywhere.
Awesome. Well, I think it's a perfect place to leave it. Unless, is there anything else we left out? Anything else you want to plug? I know there's a lot of other stuff you have in the works coming up that we probably can't talk about until it's actually official. But just believe me, Claudia's got some irons in the fire. Just any other advice for, you know, anyone listening? Just the strength of the idea, write something that no one else is doing.
Yeah, I think just, you know, really having a connection to your story goes a really long way. I think that's a question that maybe some young writers or directors don't expect when they get into a room. Mm-hmm. And I think if you can answer that, that will also carry you a long way when you hear no, because you will hear no a lot along the way. I feel like it's, you know, it never gets easy, but it's something that really, when you feel like you believe in what you're doing, and there's a need for that story to be out there, that will carry you through. And I think people respond to that level of passion and conviction in their writers and directors.
So don't just write it to write it. Write it because it comes from a place that needs, like you said Fort Bliss. You're like, I need to tell this. I'm the only one that can tell this. So, yeah.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Claudia.
Thank you for having me.
Again, it's Above the Shadows. It is. We will let you know when you can watch it and where, but it's. You said it comes on VOD.
SVOD and select theaters on July 19th.
July 19th. Awesome. Thanks, Claudia Myers.